welcome to the Evolving Media Podcast. I'm reviving this podcast a little bit after a period of hiatus, mainly brought about by me having way too many projects in the air at the same time and little time to spend on this. But there's been so much stuff happening in the world of media that I just couldn't help myself. We need to look into all these new possibilities, I think, all these platforms and methods, and see how they stack up and what they can mean for us as creators and producers. With that in mind, I had a chat with Sandra Lehner, one of the most prolific people I know when it comes to keeping a finger on the pulse of what is happening in media, be it branded entertainment, audience development, or something else. Her talks on Gen Z are eye-opening, and lately she's been talking a lot about metaverse, as well as the topic of our conversation and discussion today, NFTs, i.e. non-fungible tokens, online products registered on the blockchain with proof of ownership, basically. Our talk today dives into audience engagement and audience building, about what TV and traditional media can learn from the world of esports, about the re-emergence of media markets like MIPTV, about Gen Z as consumers and producers, and of course about NFTs. Now, NFTs do divide people to quite an extent. I don't blame you for rolling your eyes or perhaps even shutting this podcast episode down if you're in the camp that believe that NFTs have no future. Some see them as little more than a gimmick or a new tulip craze with something like bored apes going for millions when they're little more than below par artwork. Some see NFTs as the future of digital ownership and a way for everyone to participate in the earnings chain of online events. Most, admittedly, are decidedly on the sidelines so far. Mind, my talk with Sandra is from earlier this summer, so this is way before OpenSea, the probably most prolific NFT exchange, dropped its trading value by 94% just the other day. So where NFTs will go is anyone's guess. But for creators, for producers, and for people in the media, they do have an opportunity to be so much more. We're also talking about a lot of other stuff on this episode. Like for instance, Sandra's panel on what the world of TV can learn from esports, the panel that she moderated at MIPTV this year. And of course, one thing that's really close to our hearts. Audience engagement, audience interaction, and audience building. Let's dig into it.
The key word is audience first. I don't think you should start a project, you know, without this audience first approach, thinking about who is my audience, what is my audience interested in, and then you bring them along on a journey anyway.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because that doesn't mean that you have to be in, it's not necessary for you to have talked to your audience necessarily or anything, but you need to have a really firm idea of who your audience actually is, right?
Yeah, and this is what I've learned in advertising, actually, because they always create personas, they always do research on the target audience. And I think this is what a lot of TV producers are missing. They don't know their audience. They don't know who they're making this for. And I keep mentioning Scam because it's just the best example, because she was interviewing, you know, her future audience, I think for a year, and finding out stories and you know, what they care about and their problems and their music and, you know, whatever makes them tick. And this is why it was so successful. And I think a lot of producers can, especially documentary filmmakers, can learn from this. Because, documentaries, you're even closer to the protagonists. And
And if we look at Scam then, which I agree is a really good example, that also illustrates that not only if you actually connect with your audience before you start producing what you're going to produce, you know what they like, but you also and you know what their world looks like. So you can create something that fits into where they are and how they live and feels like a part of their everyday life. But she also got quite a lot of input into her own story crafting. So she knew stuff that resonated that she could put into the stories and to the drama that she was writing. So I think, I mean, that's a beautiful point as well.
And that's why it was resonating with the audience, because they felt listened to and understood, you know, and the stories were actually made for them. And because I think in a lot of Hollywood writer rooms, you know, they're like, I don't know, 40-year-old man writing teen drama. I mean, this is how it used to be, at least. And I think this is why also, you know, content creators in the sense of YouTube and Instagram creators, they resonate better with their audience because they're listening, they're on social media, they're engaging with their audience, they're creating content for them and with them. They're asking them, what are you interested in? What should I make a video next about, you know? And this is why I think they're more successful. And so I've been working with some Gen Z producers from Croatia. Shout out to Jumboos. And so we looked a lot at the Awesomeness TV model. And they actually bring in the YouTube influencers in the writer's room. So they add to the stories. So it resonates with their audience in the end.
And that's also it feels like if you look at documentary filmmakers, there's like, that's drama for a large part, right? With Scum, etc. But also if you look at something as grounded in reality as documentary filmmaking, then if you start talking to the audience well before you start filming or during your filming or whatever, then you get to know what your audience feels are the most important things to know about your subject. And what curious, I mean, if you're only working with your main characters and their look on life and following them, that's all good and well. That's probably the essence of a documentary filmmaking process. But you have your questions regarding their challenges and their lives and their narratives. But you don't know what will interest the people that you want to reach, not on a deeper level, unless you talk to them.
Yeah. 100%, Simon. Yeah. 100%. And it amazes me because I think, you know, it's so much money involved and time and effort. And it just amazes me that producers, they think so much about the story, but they don't think about the audience. They don't think about the distribution. Because I just went to Rio de Janeiro and spoke on a Gen Z panel at Rio to See. And the moderator was the head of digital at Endemol Shine in Brazil. And they just had the biggest Big Brother finale ever. And which is so interesting because, you know, I've been thinking about how old Big Brother is, and it's almost 20 years. I think it came out, I don't know, 2003 or 4, something like that.
Yeah, right? Early, yeah.
And so it was interesting. And on my panel, there were two guys, the bros, one 23-year-old and the other one 25-year-old. And they told me they have never watched an episode of Big Brother, but they knew everything that was going on and they were very engaged in it because everything was on social media. So Endemol Shine produces specifically for this audience, you know, on social media. And it's not just a marketing afterthought. It's not just something like, oh, we need to, you know, put a photo on Instagram. But they specifically think about this audience, which is not on television, and produce content for them. So they are involved in it as well, which I thought was really interesting. It's a different approach to, you know, Europe or even America, I think.
Again, a little bit, you can draw a parallel to Scum, which was releasing on the snippets on social media that then built up the final episode at the end of each week, which I mean, of course, coming from the Nordic countries, we've always had, you know, we've always had a good broadband connections quite early on in the internet era, etc. And I think we've seen here the decline in television, like regular linear television audiences, audience figures, the most or the earliest, so to speak. So over here, both in Finland and in Sweden, it's increasingly, and I'm guessing in Denmark and Norway as well, it's increasingly web first, right? So it's increasingly linear television is all good and well, and we have the channels, etc., and there's news at 8:30, etc., and so on, as it's always been, because that's how the God ordained it when he created television, basically. No, but what now happens is that if you get a commissioned form, if you get a television show commissioned, it's quite often it's web first, and that's quite liberating as a producer, because you're not tied down to a schedule or a slot or anything like that. But there's still a long way to go with regards to utilizing social media and producing social media. It's more like having people come into your VOD platform. That's what the aim of the broadcasters here. So I still think there is some way to go before we're really utilizing all the different platforms that are suitable.
I agree. Scandinavia is so much more ahead than any other European country. Because then again, when you look at Scan, the episode lengths was different, you know, each episode length was different. So I don't know, some were 20 minutes, others were 60 minutes. And I think that was interesting that you give the story as long as the story needs, you know. And I recently found out, I didn't even know that, you know, like a 30 minute sitcom, for example, used to be 22 minutes, is actually 18 now. Which was amazing, really? To me. Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, so it's just four more ad minutes in between. Mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. Oh God.
Mm-hmm. And then so what do you tell in 18 minutes? You know?
No, really. No.
It's very difficult. Yeah. And I think, you know, for storytellers, the web has much more opportunities to tell a story the way the story needs to be told and not in this frame of broadcast television.
Moving on a little bit from this and from, because I just wanted to ask you, since you were at MIP TV this year and I wasn't, so how was it? You're getting everyone back together face to face for the first time in 2 years. What was the vibe and what did you learn?
It was very positive and encouraging. Someone was saying everyone who's here wants to be here. Mm-hmm. You know how in the past there were people who were like, oh, I hate coming to Cannes. And we were saying this time everybody who's here actually wants to be here. And this was the atmosphere that everyone was just happy to see each other after the 2 years, and and everyone was reaching out. I don't know. I mean, I decided very last minute to go, but my schedule was full within a couple of days because everyone reached out and wanted to catch up. And I think it was very positive, inspiring, encouraging. Sharing knowledge, sharing experiences. So my panel was about what TV producers or traditional media producers can learn from esports. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I think because I expected it more esports people to be in the audience, but then it was actually quite the same TV and esports. So it seems like TV people are getting interested in what is esports, or, you know, gaming doing what we're not doing. And I think the main point is what we said earlier, it's about the community, you know, it's actually engaging with your community and listening to your community and giving them the content that they want.
Yeah.
So I think this was the key aspect out of the panel.
With esports, it's quite interesting because you have like potentially huge audiences that who already are really invested because they have thousands of hours gaming whatever games they're into, multiple games probably. They're really used to being connected to someone who is producing media, whether it's streaming on Twitch or something else. So they're quite prepared to be engaged with someone who does something that they are taking part of. And then you have all the IPs. I mean, I just looked, saw the first episode of the Halo series.
Yes.
Paramount. Yeah. And I mean, there's quite a lot to, and you got The Witcher and, you know, stuff like that, even though it's from a book series originally, but they turned into games, etc. So you have such an enormous amount to draw on, I'm guessing.
Exactly. I was just looking into Halo as well, actually. And it was the most watched premiere on Paramount Plus ever. And and I think this is also a key point, you know, exploring IP, because then you already bring an audience to the product. And, you know, Bridgerton, for example, is based on books. A book series, then a lot of awesomeness TV shows like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, for example, is based on a book series. So, you know, you don't take risks with these kind of products because you already have an audience that is interested in it. And also like a lot of shows, you know, based on podcasts are being produced at the moment. And also what I've learned in Cannes is that a lot of shows are based on NFTs now. I don't know if you've heard that Hello Sunshine, Reese Witherspoon's company, is developing shows based on the World of Women NFTs.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does that work? So it's just inspired by, or is it based
inspired
on?
Inspired by, yeah. Yes. And then also Time Magazine, they have a studio, a children's animation studio, and they're producing shows now based on NFTs. So it's quite interesting where the inspiration is coming now from and drawing on existing IP.
And if you look at, just looking, taking back a little bit from NFT to gaming, I'm guessing that, I mean, media companies and producers should be really interested in a multi-million head person group of people who are extremely familiar with paying micro sums for different stuff in IP they're connected to. I mean, everyone who plays CSGO is prepared to drop like $2 or $5 or whatever, or euros, on a drop and try to get some new skins for their weapons or new knives or whatever. So this, like, this financial system is already there and can conceivably, if it's done well, be brought over to other types of content as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is why, you know, we're excited about the metaverse, because it offers so many possibilities. Like you said,
it scares people as well. Yeah,
it scares people, and I think we have a long way to go. But I mean, this is the exciting part, that you can, like you said, you can buy a skin for, I don't know, Fortnite, and then you can use it in Snapchat as well. So this is the idea of the metaverse, that it's a seamless 3D experience.
I'm looking at the young people who are quite prepared to, like, the term superpositioning that was coined like years and years ago, that while we're sitting here, I'm also online and chatting with someone on WhatsApp somewhere else in the world, but I also have a game up where I'm in with my clan in World of Warcraft or some other game. So I'm here, but I'm also online with you, but I'm online with someone else and with someone else beside that. So I'm basically featuring three or four personas at the same time, which is quite interesting when it comes to creating content that resonates with those people as well.
Yeah, and I think this is also, you know, because I've been talking a lot about Gen Z and millennials recently. And so millennials were described as the two-screen generation. So with us, you know, we started on interacting on social media while we watched something on television, but actually Gen Z is now five screens. So what you're describing, you know, I could be like, they could be like on five screens multitasking. And I think this is also what producers need to remember that, you know, they might pick the story up on a different platform or a different device. So you need to think about how to engage them on different platforms.
Yes, and it, and they can reach your story also by someone they trust or know or have are in contact with. So it might be that person who introduces the story to them. And then you as a creator have no control over what's said about your content. Like what's what's their entry point? Like is it, will they come into your story with a, this is the worst shit I've ever seen? Or is it, you know, it's how do you, so you need to be able to sort of like think the, like, what was the name? What was the thing that Mike Aros said? Like, I don't tell my friends about your brand because I like your brand. I tell your friends about your brand before because I like my friends. So you need to, you need to be able to sort of like craft the entry points for anyone so that it's easy for them to look at the, your stuff the way you want them to look at it.
That's so funny that you're saying this because, so I did some research on Scam again recently, and I saw that, you know how, so the fans created a Google Doc actually where they translated the Norwegian version, and Anna Kay was so afraid, you know, because of the rights, especially the music rights, and they were like, oh my god. But this is such an interesting example where the fans just take over, you know.
Yeah.
And you can't restrict them. They just they took over the content and translated it for people all over the world, and it's such an interesting example. And the other one I want to mention is that so I found out that there are 100,000 versions of Squid Game on Roblox. So I was asking, how does Netflix feel about this, you know? Like people taking their IP and making their own out of it.
Yeah.
And but apparently it's so that they consider it research. They, you know, they can see what people like and how they use it, and that informs potentially the second season.
I think that's a very good way to look at it. But I think that one thing I've said to the filmmakers and people I've been talking to and mentoring and trying to advise on is that they also need to be prepared for success. You know, because it's as with Scum, I'm guessing NRK, the Norwegian broadcaster, were never, when they set out to produce it, they were never, you know, drawing up any plans to how to handle the audience translating everything into English and Chinese and whatever languages for it. But I mean, if you create something that is successful, and hopefully it will be successful, then the audience is going to take it and run and run with it. So how do you handle that? Like, how do you, what's the core of, what can you, what do you have to keep control of? And what can you just let go? And how can you then use that? That's a really good way of looking at it as research and as something that influences your next move or your next venture or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this is what we've always talked about when it comes to formats, right? I mean, an idea, you can't protect an idea. We all have ideas and we have similar ideas because we read the same books and we listen to the same music and we watch the same TV shows and we're all influenced. Even it's even like, I don't know, worse or better now that we're such a global world, you know, like we watch Korean TV shows and we, I don't know, and Norwegian TV shows, and we're just, yeah, have the same ideas Of course. Yeah. And it's hard to protect this. And it's all about what I've learned. It's all about the execution. And I think this is also what we can learn from Gen Z. What I realized in Brazil, they are so quick, you know, they just do it. And it was interesting. We had a conversation with an IP lawyer one night, and one of the Gen Z producers, they were using, I think, a Drake song. And the IP lawyer was like, ah, you can't really use it, you know, in like a commercial, in commercial content, and not commercial, like in a, I don't mean like in a, you know.
Yeah, professional content, so to speak.
Professional, yeah. Yes. And he was like, you know, if Drake watches my content, amazing. And if he wants to sue me, fine. So he was basically saying, I go over this bridge when I come to it. I don't know what the
expression is. Let's cross that bridge when we reach it. Yeah, something like that.
Exactly. I'm not concerning myself with it right now. And he was just like, yeah, if Drake watches my content, amazing. That was the way he saw it. And I think, you know, TV producers can learn a lot from this generation. We were also talking a lot about that they didn't go to film school. They started producing when they were 13 because they wanted to win a GoPro. There was like a GoPro film competition, and they wanted to win this GoPro. And since then, they've been producing content, and they produce content, you know, for Porsche and Mercedes and super big brands, and they just go for it. I mean, they put a Porsche on the Sugarloaf in Rio de Janeiro, you know, for a branded content video. I mean, they just go for it. And I think in television, that's especially in Europe, there's, you know, until something gets greenlit, years pass by, and then you're not, the conversation has already moved on. You know, you're not in the
absolutely
anymore.
yeah and it becomes really difficult when you put all your eggs in like one basket, and you really think, okay, this is the thing we're gonna do, and then if it's not successful, then what do you do? I mean, then you're a little out of it, so to speak. But I have to go back a little bit to what we were talking about, the NFT world and the blockchain world. Looking back, talking a little bit more about NFTs, you said that they were going to be, that there are production companies and creators like taking inspiration from NFTs right now. And I will admit that I have a little bit difficult like envisioning what all the stuff that conceivably can be done with NFTs on the blockchains. But I mean, for instance, like, how can it be used as part of a creative process? How can it be used to finance stuff? I mean, the sky's the limit if you just let your imagination roam free and what can be done with it, since it's basically digital ownership of, or a certificate of ownership of digital assets. And that could be basically anything that you can turn into a digital asset, or have a digital asset represent something in the real world. But you're involved in some NFT community as well. What was that one about?
Well, the one I'm involved in is some friends of mine in Berlin. They created an artist collective, so it's more about the artists. And I'm not... what I'm more interested in, I mean, I'm coming from an entertainment perspective, so I'm more interested in how can you use this art, what are the opportunities? When you look at, you know, the World of Women and Hello Sunshine project, so if you bought a World of Women NFT, and actually, I have a bag. Oh, this So this is a World of Women NFT. And I mean, I don't own it, right? But if I own this image and then Hello Sunshine decides, oh, this is a really cool image and she is going to be our protagonist, then they have to ask me for the rights and then I earn royalties. And then it becomes really interesting for the artist. And also here in LA, in Long Beach, I think they just opened a restaurant based on a bored ape. It's called Hungry and Bored, or Bored and Hungry, I don't know. And yeah, and then when you look at this, then it becomes really interesting because it's all on the blockchain and you have a smart contract and you know who's the owner and you earn royalties. And I drifted away, but the collective I'm involved in is about the artists and showing them the opportunities. And I think so what I've learned in the past weeks, there are two main questions. One is, how do I create a community? And the second are all the legal aspects. And So I met in Brazil, I actually met an IP lawyer who's involved in the metaverse and NFTs. And here in LA, I met at a women in Web3 networking event. I met a lawyer here based in LA. And I think, they're absolutely pioneering, no one knows what's going on in this space. It's like the Wild West. But this is why it's so exciting, because we had this question, if I buy an NFT, if I'm in Europe and I buy an NFT from an American artist, let's say from a Brazilian artist, but on an American exchange platform, which
right legislation.
So you have all these very interesting questions. And just to show you the opportunities that I see, I think in the beginning it was all about the NFT drops, you would just release digital images like as collectibles. And I don't really believe in that. I think, if you have something like Marvel, then yes, you're collectible. It's a very specific community, that's the fan community, and they would pay a high price for a collectible. But I don't think this is the mainstream. And I think that might work for the Bored Apes and for World of Women. But again, I'm not sure they're going to be as valuable in 5 years. I think Spider-Man will be, because it's just, it's such a big brand, but I'm not sure about the Bored Apes. But this is kind of what's happening at the moment. Everyone is creating these digital images. But then what do you do with it? And what I think is more interesting is using it as a gateway. So Gary V is doing this with V Friends. So because I didn't even know that he likes to doodle. So he was drawing, I don't know what he was drawing, cats or something, I don't remember. And he was selling these NFTs, but the NFTs were more like a ticket to his online education platform that you can use. And also the Super Bowl here in LA, they released NFTs and it was more like a VIP ticket. And I think then it becomes interesting, because then it's like a ticket into a community.
It's like a magic key to another world.
And then it's all about the DAOs in the end, the decentralized decentralized autonomous organizations. It's interesting when you start to have a vote on something, so you could, for example, Gary V could say, so I have a workshop on NFTs and I have a workshop on YouTube videos, which one do you want to have released next month? And then the community can vote and you release whatever they vote for. And it's just about ownership. It's about being part of it and having a say in something. And I think, yeah, and when you take this to television and movies, documentaries even, you know, then I think it's the future of financing. It's people getting involved in your project and helping you finance it and then also be a part of it. And I mean, you can go, you know, as interactive as you want to go. You could also ask them about storylines. Should we go this way or should we do this? And
And I mean,
I think it becomes interesting for the future because I don't, you know, I don't care if cryptocurrency is down and, you know, people are saying NFTs are a bubble. I just feel like this is the way forward that people want to get more involved. And it's actually interesting. I also, I saw a study recently that Gen Z, they watch 50% professionally produced content and 50% creator content, content. And I think it's gonna go even more towards the creator produced content, you know?
Yeah.
And I think Hollywood studios have to understand that, again, we're coming back to what we were talking in the beginning, is audience first. And you know, if you just produce because Netflix tells you, oh, we want a show on a, I don't know, a man being pregnant. I don't know, you know.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking regarding NFTs? Like one example came to me that I read about. Like, there's just one very simple example of how it can be used. Was that if you remember, and they're still going on, I'm guessing, these autograph signing like fairs and stuff like that. So you meet a star from back in the days or a new or whomever, someone, and they have a niche following perhaps in a certain area, and you meet them and you get their autograph and you pay them like $5 or $10 for having your picture taken with them and getting the autograph. But in the same vein, you could meet that person in Fortnite, and you can grab a screenshot, and you can have that screenshot as an NFT to just show that you've actually interacted with your favorite streamer or whatever, and you buy that NFT for $5, and it's yours forever to keep from that, just like an autograph in the old world, so to speak. So, I mean, the possibilities, I guess, are endless. But as you were saying, it all comes back to finding the audience and knowing what they want and how they want to involve themselves. And yeah, if you can do that, then, I mean, conceivably, you could take your documentary film and then you can make every frame of that 90 minutes into one separate NFT. And everyone who invests in your show gets one frame, and then you can share profits with those NFT holders for every frame they hold. You know, it's, I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, and I think what I've learned, you know, like what it comes down to, the more I think about it, is community. And I think this is why, because I watched this panel on NFTs at MIP TV, and they were saying, again, like, you know, whatever, cryptocurrency is down, but you need to have NFTs in your long-term strategy. You know, it's not something, because I feel like a lot of producers, they're like, you know, oh, there's something shiny. Oh, there's something shiny. Oh, I have to do this. I have to do this. But they don't understand why they're doing this. They're just doing it because everyone is doing it. But you know, Fox has their own NFT department. And the guy from the NFT department, he was speaking at MIP TV, and he was saying they're investing in this long term. So they're thinking more about the next 5 years and 10 years. And it's about the community. You know, it's not just we're dropping this and then we move on to the next shiny thing. It's actually thinking about the community, building a community and giving them value over time, you know, and engaging them over time. And I think this is the problem that Netflix is having at the moment, that they don't really have. Remember, like 10 years ago when we were talking about transmedia and everyone was like, oh, yes, transmedia.
Yes.
But I think this
even
is 12 it,
years ago,
you know?
13 years ago. Yes.
Yes. This is it, because this is why Disney Plus is so much more successful now, you know, than Netflix, because Netflix doesn't have these franchises. They don't actually own the IP. The IP goes back to, I don't know, Sony or, you know, whoever produced it. And and this is their issue. And they have to create entertainment worlds. And then within these entertainment worlds, you can do NFTs or video games or, you know, whatever your strategy is. But I think this is what they have to consider, that it's all about IP and then expanding this IP in any way possible, or in any way you want to go, basically.
Yeah. And I will add on that I still don't tell anyone, but I'm still using the term transmedia from time to time, or at least transmedia, like the transmedia principles, when it comes to looking at what you're trying to create. Then you should always, in my mind, try to find out, like, is it rooted in what kind of story world is it rooted in, and what other stories can you find in that story world? And to find those stories, you need to reach out to whomever has an agency within that story world, the audiences, the characters, the protagonists, everyone, and find out, like, what other stories are there and how interesting are they to audiences, and what can I build from them that will support my main project, so to speak. And what do you know, perhaps one of them will become the long-running thing that ties your projects together to a Marvel Cinematic Universe or whatever. But unless you explore them, then you, and unless you acknowledge them and explore them, you won't find them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting, because right now in this streaming war, you know, they're all about people signing up. But this is actually one of my predictions for this year, that there will be a lot of consolidation, because people sign up to watch one particular show and then they cancel their subscription and they sign up with another service for another show. And I think now it's more about retention. How can I keep I keep them engaged by producing specials, for example, spin-off shows of, you know, the entertainment franchises that the audience loves. And again, I think Disney is doing a really good job here.
What I don't understand is, why doesn't Netflix or any of the other big streaming services, when they have a hit show like Stranger Things or the Game of Thrones or whatever, they could conceivably have, for every hour of high budget, high production level drama that they make, they could make 20 hours of people sitting and discussing and debating and talking about this stuff. And, you know, and people would go, oh, I'll watch this on Netflix, not on YouTube, because Netflix is already, let's see what they have to say about this. I mean, it's comparably very small budget and easy to produce, and it would retain interest and loyalty and engagement from anyone who cares about the IP.
I think they're doing this around genres, so they're doing this around K-drama and anime. They have like all these YouTube channels, but not about the story. It's not around the IP. It's more around genres.
On that note, that everyone needs to start doing more and better stuff. Basically, I think we'll end this episode here, and I will look forward to talking to you very soon again, I hope. No matter where in the world you happen to be at that time.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you.
Ooh.